Okay. Last week, we traced the Rav from Warsaw to Berlin, and we noticed that in Warsaw he was exposed to the great Hasidic world, and the Hasidic world is the world that made Agudat Yisrael Agudat Yisrael. As I explained, the Litvish Rosh Yeshiva could not necessarily deliver all their students. The Hasidic world, by definition of being a Hasid, the definition means that you surrender your mind, your thinking process on these issues to your Rebbe. And if the Rebbe says one has to join Agudat Yisrael, the Gerer Rebbe joins Agudat Yisrael, then tens of thousands of Hasidim join with the Rebbe. Of course, the level of life in Warsaw among the Hasidic world, as the Rebbe said many times, they lived in the poorer neighborhoods, they were the poorer Jews. And if I can paraphrase, they probably observed their Aguda commitments on the level of a Shalashuddas in a Shtibel. In Berlin, the Rebbe was exposed to Agudat Yisrael with a PhD. And here, of course, you find exactly what perhaps he's searching for at that moment in life, the ability to be a Torah Jew and yet to interact and be part of the Western world. And that was unique to Aguda in Germany, where many of the Agudistim were graduates of the Hildesheimer Seminary. Inevitably, all these rabbis had doctorates. Many of the lay leaders were educated as well, and you certainly lived on a very high Western fashion. The Rev comes to America. We spoke about Boston in detail. We spoke about his relationship with Reb Lazer Silver. His relationship with Reb Lazer Silver is crucial because during this stage of his life, Reb Lazer Silver is the role model for the Rav. And Reb Lazer Silva, who beyond any question of a doubt is the American rabbi, the American Rav from the old school, who achieves international prestige simply being a rabbi. He was never a Rosh Yeshiva. He was the rabbi first of Harrisburg, then Springfield, but then Cincinnati, where he comes in his prime, president of the Agudas HaRabbanim, the man who establishes the Var Hatzalah, the salvation work, and Reb Lazer becomes an international figure. And of course, we spoke about last week in 1937, the last Knesiyah Gedola before the Holocaust, Marian Bar Czechoslovakia. Reb Lazer Silva meets his Rebbe, goes out, seeks his Rebbe, Reb Chaim Moshe Grzynski, then the elder rabbi, statesman, respondent, leader, political leader of the Orthodox Jews, particularly in Lithuania, White Russia, Agudat Yisrael, the man who was the equal, as if to say, of the Chafetz Chaim in prestige and fame. And Rav Chaim Moshe says to his Talmud, Lazer, Shein Zeit, as man darf grinden an Agudas Yisrael in America. Reb Lazer, my student, it's time that you organize Agudat Yisrael in America. Now, this doesn't mean there was an Aguda before. Aguda technically began to function in America in 1922. However, until 1937, as we explained last time, it functioned on a very low key, on a low burner. You did not have people who had Agudas inclinations. People who came to America, by and large, were Mizrahi people. The Agudistim remained behind in Europe. But by 1937, people were coming to America not because they wanted to. They were coming to America not because America was America. They were coming to America to escape from what was developing with Germany and the Nazis. And therefore, you now have Hasidic people coming and Litvisha people coming and people who are determined, committed to remain from in America. And when Reb Lazer comes back, he organizes Agudat Yisrael. By 1938, there's the first convention, and Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, is the chairman of the executive committee, Yoshev Rosh Var HaPoel. And as I mentioned, when they organize Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, he is a member of the first Council of Torah Sages in the United States. Nothing equals my Rebbe's hesped for Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski at the 1940 Aguda Convention. It is the clearest, most dynamic, philosophic Aguda statement ever made on American soil. And I begin today quoting from the heart of the hesped and showing you references to incidents that I referred to last week that happened in the 1930s, and you see the way my Rebbe, the way the Rav thought at that moment in time. I want to state, for the sake of scholarship, that in the second volume of my collected published writings, Rakofet Aharon, in the Hebrew section, I have a major scholarly essay analyzing this hesped, and it gives all the relevant sources and the background of what Rabbi about what the Rav or my Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, is referring to. But I just want to replay for you the heart of the hesped. The heart of the hesped is magnificent, and it becomes the title for this hesped. It's been reprinted many times. I'm quoting to you from Divrei HaGutva HaRacha, which was put out by the Jewish Agency in the 1970s, page 191. But I have to say the hesped originally appeared in Hapades, in the Rabbinic Journal, and the Rebbe allowed it to be published, even though it was a stage in his life where he didn't allow publication. He still was the brisker perfectionist. He had not mellowed, but he considered this eulogy so important that at a very early stage, he allowed it to be public. And the Rav describes in his immutable style who is the high priest. What characterizes the high priest? The high priest wears two garments that no other priest wears, that these garments determine. These garments are the signature of the high priest. The tzitz and the choshen. What is the tzitz? The headplate, kodesh l'Hashem, holy to God. What is the choshen? The breastplate. What do you have on the breastplate? The beautiful jewels that symbolize the beautiful stones, the precious stones that symbolize the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Rebbe explains, what do the tzitz, what does the headplate and the breastplate represent? The headplate, the tzitz, holy to God, represents a mind committed to Torah. It represents halacha. It represents Sheilat Tshuvot, response to literature. It represents spiritual guidance. This is the mind that has to decide the most difficult questions. We have to decide whether something is kasher, whether something is treif, whether something is permissible, whether something is forbidden, whether something is pure, whether something is impure. All the most difficult halachic questions, you refer to the head plate, to the tzitz, to the mind of the Kohen Gadol who has to make all these decisions. What is the Choshen Mishpat? The Choshen Mishpat refers to the political, daily, mundane questions that face the Jewish people, that face the totality of the Jewish nation, that face the 12 tribes. And whenever you have a question dealing with a political reality, dealing with a temporal reality, this is not a question of pure halacha. This is not a question of whether it's permissible or not permissible in a halachic sense. But you need political, you need everyday, temporal, mundane guidance. What to do, what not to do, how to act, how not to act. Those questions, too, you must refer to the Kohen Gadol. And the Rav says this is the classic way of Jewish thinking. The same beautiful mind that is holy and sacred to the Lord, that decides the questions of your Adaya, and decides the questions of Ebenezer, and decides the questions of Orachayim, that same mind has to be the one we consult when we need everyday mundane questions of how to live, how to act, how to relate, how to respond. Questions that are far from a pure halachic question, but rather a question that deals with ruling and governing and how the Jewish people must act on a daily basis. And the Rav says, Chas v'chalila, we should separate between the two. And he makes reference. See, this is already, if I can define it, what you see here is a practical definition of Das Teira. What does Das Teira mean? That the great Rabbanim have to decide on all matters. Lay people have little input into these decisions. And it's not just a halachic decision, but even beyond. A mundane, temporal, everyday, down-to-earth question. These questions, too, the great rabbis have to decide. And the Rav makes reference. What did we speak about last week? There was the late 30s. Jews saw what was happening with Hitler. The Zionists, particularly that element, the activists, called for boycott. And Agudat Yisrael was totally opposed. And the Rav in this drasha makes absolute reference. Tzarich ani lemchot keneged malchut zu shechsivet Yisrael alo. Do I have to protest? Do I have to boycott? We don't allow this question to be decided by political leaders. We don't allow this question to be decided by lay leaders. The great Rabbanim who tell you treifa kasher have to tell you whether or not to boycott. And their word must be totally followed. And you see the Rebbe, and he repeats this a number of times in the eulogy for Reb Chaim Moshe, that he was opposed to boycotting Germany. He felt that Jews who listened to the political leaders, to the Zionist leaders, to the secular leaders, were led astray. And that the great Rabbanim, if they say not to boycott, to depend upon shtadlanut, to depend upon quiet diplomacy, listen to the great rabbis. Do not boycott. And you have referenced right here to an issue that in 38 and 39 was a cause celebre on the American scene. And Agudat Yisrael was vilified. Read the Silver Era. You'll see some of the quotes I bring there. They were vilified by others for not supporting the boycott. And the Rav sides with Agudat Yisrael. Not just that. In this Hesped, there is reference to all that went on in Vilna. Remember I told you that there had been tremendous controversy in Vilna over electing a chief rabbi. And for 200 years, the tradition was in Vilna, or close to 200 years, the tradition was in Vilna that there is no chief rabbi. The Vilna Gaon played no role in the act of Rabnet, but I explained to you there had been a Rabbeinu Shmuel, had been rabbi, there was a big machloket to succeed him, how to elect. And they finally decide in Vilna to avoid machloket, the city would never again have a chief rabbi. And Vilna functioned with a number of Rabbanim who were Dayanim, who were formed the Beitin. They had the responsibility for the city. And throughout the millennium, throughout the years, there were Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael, great Rabbanim. You see Reb Chaim Moshe Grushinsky. By virtue of being Reb Chaim Moshe, by virtue of being the author of the three volumes of the Achi Ezra, he became, as if to speak, the chief rabbi, the leading spiritual rav in Vilna. And nevertheless, after World War I, the Mizrahi and other elements elected Rabbi Yitzchak Rubinstein, and he was a rabbi, but he was not allowed to mix in politics. His job was limited to paskin, to give advice on a halachic matter, not to go beyond on political issues. And the Balabatim, the community, the Vad, Ha'ir, they were the ones that dealt with non-halachic matters. And the Rav comes out very strongly against Rabbi Rubinstein and this approach. In recent times, a new viewpoint was born. That differentiates between the individual who wears the head plate and the individual who wears the breastplate. Between the man who's a gaon in Torah and the man who is a political leader. And Shitazu, this new viewpoint says that the giants of Torah, whose mind is entirely suffused with learning and holiness, and whose hands, he's paraphrasing the Gemara in Brachas, and whose hands are dirty with the blood of the woman. What does the Gemara say? That to be mater a woman, the Gedolei Yisrael have to look at the Dam Nida and make a decision whether pure or impure. And these giants whose minds are entirely holy, whose hands are dirty with the Shafir and the Shilya, they are not eligible, they are not capable, they cannot carry the breastplate. They do not have to deal with all the difficult daily political mundane questions that the Jewish people face. The great giants of Torah who paskin the most difficult questions of halacha, like Aguna, have no right to an opinion when it comes to political questions that come to our door morning after morning. They have attempted to put a wedge between the breastplate and the head plate. And I don't have to tell you, the Rav here, this is 100% Das Teira. This is 100% Agudat Yisrael theology. And no one said it more beautifully than the Rav. This is homiletics, the breastplate. with the head plate that sits and the choshen mishpat, and the Rav ends off the hesped very dramatically. Hagon Reb Chaim Oysa lacham al zeh becheref nefesh. He gave his life to fight this new division that Jews are seeking. He fought and suffered because of his viewpoint. Saval yisurei nefesh veruach. And he says, we're living at a time where so many of our brethren are willing to give away the breastplate to strangers who have no feeling and commitment and knowledge of Torah and Yirat Shemayim. They're willing to give it away. And all they want, all they say is, the rabbi has to wear the head plate, but the breastplate belongs to others. And now, at this moment, the Rav ended off, when we eulogize Rav Chaim Moza, I say to you, these are the words of his final will and testament. Conquer the choshen. Conquer the breastplate. Give it back to Gedolei Yisrael. Ki goyalo shel hatzitz karuch bazeh. Because the ultimate destiny of what will happen to the breastplate will depend upon the head plate. The ultimate destiny, the opposite. The ultimate destiny of the head plate, of the tzitz, will depend upon the breastplate, will depend upon the choshen mishpat. Conquer it back. Don't let this division happen. Don't allow this cleavage to go any further. Knit it together. Bring it together. Mend it together. Tachzira teret liyoshno. Turn back and do and act the way Jews have acted throughout the millennium. And bring back the unity of the choshen and the tzitz, the breastplate and the headplate. And this is the final command, the final wish, the last testament of Rav Chaim Isaac Grishinsky. I need not tell you that this drasha, which the Rav published and republished so many times during his lifetime, after his lifetime, this is I've heard this from Agudah leaders, there was never a finer statement of a good theology on American soil than that drasha from the Rav on the tzitz and on the choshen, so that there can be no doubt in our minds that 1930 into the early 1940s, the Rav was totally, completely identified with Agudat Yisrael. And referring to the document we analyzed a week ago in 1935 when he stood for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv, we now can understand why the Rav took for granted that that document was referring to him, because the document implies he was an Agudist, not a Mizrachist. And that was his mindset at that moment in time. Right after this eulogy is given, right after Reb Chaim Weiss's demise, and I have to tell you, I spoke with many survivors. I yet knew many survivors, of course, at today. Not that many are left alive, but I knew many survivors from the crowd that ultimately is saved via Shanghai. And time and again I heard from them that the jolt that made them take the chance to go to Japan, to go to such a strange area, to go against the advice of many great Rabbanim, is when Reb Chaim Moza died, they felt all hope was lost. As long as he was alive, as long as he functioned in Vilna, the yeshiva poured into Vilna, Reb Chaim Moza took charge of them, he located them in shuls within Vilna, in the suburbs of Vilna, he raised money, Reb Lazer Silva was able yet to send hundreds of thousands of dollars, he even sent, as we said last week, Reb Dr. Shmuel Schmidt, he even sent an emissary to check what was happening. There was hope. When Reb Chaim Moza died, all was lost. And many were desperate and took that tremendous risk of going such a strange path. It's so illogical. Japan, afterwards Shanghai, what are Jews doing there? And yet those were saved, and those who were left behind inevitably did not survive. And the Rav, this beautiful chesed, you feel an era has ended. This is Reb Chaim Moza. This is the head of Agudat Yisrael. This is someone Reb Lazer Silva revered as his Rebbe, someone the Rav revered as the great Reb Chaim Moza, the Talmud of Elushin, the Talmud of the Rav's forebears, the Chava of the Rav's father, and that whole generation. And this is the Rav's eulogy for Reb Chaim Moza. The war breaks out, and an event happens in 1943, which leaves a deep scar on Rebbe's life. You'll ask me, what gives Aaron Rakefet the audacity to say that something that happened in 43 leaves a deep scar? If you've listened to the Rav, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and even into the 80s, time and again he refers to this incident. And in my humble opinion, this incident was very important, influential in the Rav's subsequent thinking process. And I'll show it later today and I'll continue next week. But first, what is the event? I'm quoting, and I could quote from many different sources, because the Rav repeated the story time and again, but I'm quoting from the Rav, my work on the Rav, it's volume 2, 1807, page 157. And this is a talk he gave at the yeshiva, December 30th, 1980. What do I mean, a talk he gave at the yeshiva? In the Rav's later years, he spent more time in New York. Obviously, he was ill and he was feeble. Travel was difficult. So he would come into New York basically on Monday and first go back to Boston on Thursday. Of course, by this time, the Rav was internationally famous, and the students realized it was the final years in which they could take advantage of the man who yet linked them with Volozhin and Brisk. And the students at YU pleaded with Rebbe to give Hashkafa talks in addition to the Shiurim. And these, in a desultory fashion, in a haphazard fashion, in other words, due to health and other factors, it wasn't every week, but for a number of weeks, intermittently, from 1979 through 1980, the Rav gave a number of public Hashkafa talks in the yeshiva, which, of course, thousands attended. And this particular talk was on Pashat Shmot, and the Rav starts talking about, he's dealing here with worshipping idols and having total faith in people to the point that it becomes absurd, halachically forbidden, and he starts talking about World War II. And he comes back to the theme that in World War II, we didn't yell enough, we didn't shout enough, we didn't complain enough. And then he tells an unbelievable story. And he describes 1943. Now, by 1943, you have to understand, everyone, every member of the Jewish community in the United States, anyone who thought as a Jew, knew what Hitler was doing. 1941, people did not yet know, people did not believe. 1942, the first stories came out, and the State Department squelched them. They didn't want the stories to be publicized. They felt it would harm the American war effort. There would be too many demands to help the Jews, and America now is fighting a colossal war on many fronts. These great Zionist leaders, the famous before rabbis, Silva Weiss, have been accused of cooperating with the State Department and squelching this material, which was starting to come through, particularly from Switzerland and other places. Within a few months, it became public knowledge. The State Department, the Zionist leaders, the Torah people, the Rabbanim, the Bar Hatzalah, everyone knew already what was happening. By 1943, no one could put their head in the sand. And Jews were desperate because they knew that every moment they walked around freely in the United States and Canada, thousands upon thousands of Jews were being executed, were being murdered in the old country. Finally, right before Yom Kippur, 1943, the Agudat HaRabbanim declared a rabbinic march upon Washington to influence public opinion, to influence the president. Something desperate has to be done to save the Jews. Now, this march took place on October 6, 1943. It was a Wednesday. That year, Yom Kippur was on Shabbat. So look what we're talking about. It was literally a day and a half before Erev Yom Kippur. I don't have to tell you what Yom Kippur means to a Jew, what Yom Kippur means to a rabbi, what Yom Kippur means particularly to a Rav, a member of the Agudas Rabbanim. And this was the Agudas Rabbanim then, which was in full strength yet. You have to remember, Rabbinical Council of America had barely begun. It barely is getting an address at this time. The Rabbanim in America, by and large, in all the East European communities throughout the length and breadth of the United States and Canada, they all have European Rabbanim, even if the people are not religious. But the grandparents, by this time, let's say three generations, the grandparents can only identify with Rabbanim like this. The children who are American-born all speak Yiddish and all have a benevolent attitude toward such Rabbanim. The grandchildren already obviously look upon it as something out of the past, and they already are seeking out conservative temples. But these were the Rabbanim, and these were very famous Rabbanim, Rabbi Lazar Silva of Cincinnati. There was Rabbi Bernard Leventhal of Philadelphia. He was the leading rabbi in all of Philadelphia, and he was already Americanized. This was a Talmud, this was a Mismach, a Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan Spector, where he had Smich, he was a Talmud Chacham. He was European, and yet he was Americanized. There was Rabbi Israel Rosenberg, who was the leader of the Agudas HaRabbanim in the New York area, and one after another, Rabbanim from Boston and Springfield, and you name the community, they were represented by members in the Agudas HaRabbanim, and Yom Kippur, what Yom Kippur means, what Erev Yom Kippur means, and the Wednesday before, they stopped everything they were doing, they stopped all their responsibilities, and they marched upon Washington, D.C. to see the president. Over 200 Rabbanim. The Rav said in his talk in 1980, 500 Rabbanim, but the figure is someplace, I once saw that it's close to 300 Rabbanim. It's over 200, close to 300 Rabbanim. The Shenstah, the finer Rabbanim, their pictures that survive of the period, and you see all the Rabbanim with beards and black clothes and dressed like Rabbanim, and they come to Washington, and the President of the United States refuses to see them. That's how much power they had. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Refuses to see them. They came, they had reporters, they spoke, they had English speakers. There were a bunch of them there who spoke perfect English. The President refused to see them. His Jewish advisors told them, forget about these people. They have no influence. They're not important. Finally, they sent out the Vice President, Henry Wallace, to meet with them. And you understand how much influence a Vice President of the United States had at that moment in time. Henry Wallace finally came out. And the Rav said, I quote, when the Agudas Rabbanim organized a march on Washington, Roosevelt refused to see them. It was the day before of Yom Kippur, and yet Roosevelt refused to see them. Nothing helped. Roosevelt let Henry Wallace, who was then the Vice President, receive the delegation of the Agudas HaRabbanim. The Jewish people did not react to the event, did not react. Underline those words, did not react. As a matter of fact, many, particularly the Jewish press, enjoyed the spectacle. 500 Rabbanim went to Washington. These Rabbanim sent a delegation of 5 rabbis to meet with the President. Not 5. And even these 5, he did not receive them. You know what's amazing? You think this is only the Rav that leaves this memoir time and again and speaks about it. Not just the Rav. If you check the late Boston Rebbetzin, Rachel Horowitz left a memoir. It's called The Boston Rebbetzin Remembers. It was published by Masora in 1996. Look at page 112, and on page 112, you will find the Boston Rebbetzin practically in the exact words of frustration, of fear, of heartache, of regret, of remorse, says exactly what the Rav said time and again. It was a traumatic, shocking, frustrating event. Hundreds of Rabbanim, the Shensta and the Feinsta, the nicest, the finest Rabbanim, among them magnificent English orators who already knew how to speak, and knew the idiom of the land. And with it all, they were mocked, they were decried. Erev Yom Kippur, days before Yom Kippur, hours before Yom Kippur, Roosevelt refuses to see them, the Jewish press mocks them, and here hundreds of thousands of Jews, the extermination machines are working around the clock. This is 1943, when it's not yet clear that Hitler's going to lose the war, and the extermination machines are working around the clock, and they are mocked and derided. And that event leaves a deep scar that has unbelievable implications, as we will see, on the Rav's soul. So we have these two events. We have, number one, his hesped for Reb Chaim Isaac Rishinsky, which is a total agudas das Torah position, 100%. The war breaks out, there are no more conventions, basically. Not much can be accomplished. Everyone is caught up in the war effort. But in 1943, you have the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada, in their futile effort to be received by the President of the United States, while hundreds of thousands of Jews are being butchered, are being killed. And then the war ends, and then comes 1946, and it's amazing. From 1946 till the day of his death, Rav Soloveitchik publicly and totally identified with the Mizrahi movement. Mizrahi Stationery listed him as honorary president, if not from 1946 on, shortly thereafter. And of course, this question begs an answer. What happened? Que pasa? Ma kara kan? The Rav, you're dealing with Rav Soloveitchik. You're not dealing with a teenager who changes his mind from day to day. You're dealing with the grandson of Reb Chaim Brisker, the great-grandson of the Beit HaLevi, the great-great-great-grandson of the Netziv. What happened? You're dealing with the man who looked to Reb Lazer Silva and continued a warm, ongoing relationship with Reb Lazer Silva to the day that Reb Lazer died in 1968. Eulogized him at yeshiva in a wonderful talk that the Rav gave following his death. What happened here? So much has been written. There's no need to write anything, no need to engender any theories. We are very blessed. The Rav himself explained what happened. And in this explanation, in my humble opinion, this is the most important theological class, hashkafic idea that the Rav ever engendered, ever developed, and ever allowed to be published. The implications of what we're about to say are far-reaching, way beyond this very moment, some 50 years after the Rav first expressed it. Now, where did the Rav express it? And here we need a little bit of background. As I mentioned last week, the Mizrahi movement before World War II was extremely powerful in the United States. It was the only act in town. Agudah existed on paper till 1937, but it was only a paper existence, an office and no more. Following World War II, with the tremendous influx of the DPs and the survivors and the Hasidim and Rav Aaron Cutler, we have to understand that a very deep split develops in American Orthodoxy. Perhaps there were traces of this difference of opinion before. There's no question that Torah Vadas, as it developed under Mr. Shraga Feivelman, the Lovitch, is a different institution than what is today Yeshiva University. Torah Vadas began originally as a Mizrahi-oriented institution. Mr. Mendel Lovitch, who was not anti-anything Taredic, but under his aegis, when YU, or what today is YU, when Yeshiva Shmuel Chanan opens a college, a lot of parents in Brooklyn want Torah Vadas to open a college. I write about this in Bernard Revel. You can see all the details. But unlike Bernard Revel, who acted on his own, Mr. Mendelovich contacts Reb Elchanan Wasserman, and that's the famous response of Reb Elchanan Wasserman, L'chochem echad b'chutzlaretz me'eva layam, to a wise man across the sea. That response was written to Mr. Mendelovich, and it was totally opposed to opening a college and putting it under one roof with a yeshiva like they did at Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. So Torah V'Das does not organize a college, but the split was not that pronounced. People went back and forth. There were Torah V'Das boys that came to Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. There were Yeshiva boys who wanted a more Hasidic environment, went to Torah V'Das. When Rabbi Revel died in 1940, Bet Kislev, December 1st or December 2nd, 1940, actually died December 2nd, it was a few minutes after midnight. When Rabbi Revel died, there were tremendous ads of condolence published in the Jewish newspapers by Torah V'Das, signed by Mr. Mendelovich and the entire faculty. Following World War II, the split became more pronounced. First of all, the Hasidic element came to America, the Hungarian element, the Satmar element, the Kloisenberg element, and these people were not Zionist. Many of them were not even Agudistim. They stood aside from Aguda. Change is not necessary. Chadash Asum and HaTorah, as we explained, anything new is not needed, and they stood aside even from Agudat Yisrael. But more than the Hasidic elements, the most dominant figure to come to America was Rav Aaron Cutler. And Rav Aaron came from the Lithuanian world that nurtured the Rav. Rav Aaron came from Slabodka. Rav Aaron was a Talmud of students of Volozhin. Rav Aaron yet knew the earlier generation. And Rav Aaron, all of 5'1", the most charismatic leader that the Lithuanian world will ever have on American soil. And Rav Aaron went with his viewpoint that America is no different. You have to have a yeshiva gavoha, organizes the Beit Medrash gavoha, which is a continuation of his yeshiva in Kletz, which is a continuation of the yeshiva in Sklutsk, and no college permissible. And you all know the development. It's not just Lakewood. The influence of Lakewood goes way beyond to all the yeshivot in America, a negative attitude towards secular studies, a negative attitude towards Western culture, a negative attitude towards broadening. A yeshiva boy in America is no different than a yeshiva boy in Lipton in White Russia. Ki b'metorat Hashem chetzo, v'gita bo yomim v'layla, day and night, there's no time for anything else. Now, Rav Aaron not only brought Lithuanian Torah with this entire concept of shutting down Volozhin rather than introduce secular studies, which happened in 1892 to America, he brought the concept of Agudat Yisrael to America. And Rav Aaron took an Agudat Yisrael without any compromise, with all that that implies, Agudat Yisrael, and then the Chinuch Atzmai in Israel, the Agudat Yisrael educational system that Rav Aaron single-handedly supported and brought in donors and enabled it to take its place on the map, because at that time, the Agudat Yisrael Chinuch system, educational system, received very little funding from the Israeli government. And it had to be supported by money raised outside the state of Israel. And like today, when 100% of its operating budget is covered by the Israeli government. And Rav Aaron was this dynamo, Rav Aaron was this great individual, and Rav Aaron and the Rav enjoyed a warm relationship. Despite their differences in Hashkafa, there was an ongoing relationship between them. Now, more than anyone else, Rav Aaron's adherence to Aguda, to Das Torah, to Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, this made Aguda into a major institution on the American scene. But yet in the 1950s, there still was a viable Mizrahi organization. Over the years, Aguda, as if to speak, conquers America. And the reason may be very simple, I just say this in parentheses, because Mizrahi succeeded so that all its best sons and daughters went in Aliyah. So that in the state of Israel, you have, without exaggeration, tens of thousands. If you count their children today, it probably goes well over 100,000 Jews, men, women, and children, three generations, all of Anglo-Saxon origins, who were influenced to come in Aliyah by their adherence to the Mizrahi movement. So obviously, when a movement loses its best sons and daughters to the state of Israel, the movement becomes weak back in the United States. Gooder, on the other hand, that never preaches Aliyah, never preached Aliyah in that sense like Mizrahi did, their sons and daughters, by and large, remain behind. They remain behind, and it's Hasidim, and it's Litvakin, and they have Rebbeim and Rashi Yeshiva, they have leadership, and they have followers, and they became the dominant organization. But in the 1950s, it was not so yet, and there were two organizations vying for the minds and the supports of the masses of American Torah Jews. One was Agudah, one was Mizrahi. Mizrahi held the convention once a year. Generally, it was around Thanksgiving Day. It was out in the, as I recall, in Long Beach, in the Far Rockaway area, in the few kosher hotels that were there. And inevitably, Rabbi Soloveitchik's speech was the high point of the convention. Five of these drashot were so powerful that one of the Rav's great devotees had a seat in the stock exchange. Mr. Oscar Gruss prevailed upon the Rav to allow him to publish at his expense these five drashot. These drashot were given in Yiddish, and they were originally published in Yiddish. Later, they were translated into Hebrew under the title Chamesh Drashot, and the Hebrew edition has gone through quite a number of editions that were translated by Rabbi Telzner Zichrono Levracha, who was to a certain degree a devotee of the Rav, came in Aliyah many decades ago, and he translated and published the Chamesh Drashot. Afterwards, it was translated from the Hebrew into the English, and that just recently was republished by the Torah Tavrav Foundation. What's fascinating is that it's a translation of a translation of the original. In other words, the original publication was in Yiddish. It was then translated into Hebrew. The people today who did the English did not do it from the Yiddish, but they did it from the Hebrew. So that it's a translation of a translation of a translation, but nevertheless, the family says in the introduction to the new publication, which is not a new edition, it's just a republication, a photo offset of what was published years ago in English, The Rav Speaks, it's called in English, The Rav Speaks. I don't know, now it may have a new title, but the original title in English was The Rav Speaks, Chamesh Drashot, the Fimf Drashes, Chamesh Drashot, The Rav Speaks. And they state in the introduction that although it's a translation of a translation, still you can see that it resembles the original Yiddish. And now let us begin. Here is the Rav in the 50s at the Mizrahi Convention. And the Rav says, why did I become a Mizrahiite? Why did I leave Agudat Yisrael? Why did I give up? Why did I give up my family heritage? Why did I give up my own background? Why did I allow myself to enter a position which could engender and cause much anguish and pain? And here the Rav describes, and this is what I refer to, he's really describing his own father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He says, do you know what it was like to become a Mizrahiite in Europe? Do you know what it was like when everyone was separated from you? When no one wanted to talk with you? When they threw you out of the shtiblach? When they forced you to leave the rabbinate? When they embarrassed you on every step? And that's exactly a description of Reb Moshe, and you can read more about it in Shulamit Soloveitchik Meiselman's memoir. She describes how her father suffered in Warsaw and what he went through from the moment he became a Mizrahiite. So you see that his father's suffering left a deep impression upon the Rav. And this can very well explain why he became an Agudist in the 20s into the 30s after he saw his father's suffering. He saw his father being, as if to speak in popular language, being put into cherem, being excommunicated by his friends, by the old Voloshin crowd, by his father's students, by Reb Chaim's Talmidim. He saw what his father went through. And then he saw his father's difficulties, as we spoke about last week, with Reb Meir Balaban in the Tachkamoni, with this whole approach to scientific Jewish scholarship. So the Rav felt, let me be an Agudist, let me be an Agudist with a PhD, let me be an Agudist like the Agudistim in Berlin, like Reb Lazer Silva. These were worldly people with world understanding, with a wide and diversified hashkafa. So the Rav became an Agudist. Why should he suffer? And now we ask this unbelievable question: why did I change? Why did I give it up? Why do I allow myself to suffer? Why have I put myself in such a position? And the Rav gave an unbelievable drasha. See, when the Rav had an idea to give, he garbed it, he clothed it with semantics. Think of the way he spoke about the Chaim Isaac Rizhinsky, the tzitzvah hachoshen, the head plate and the breastplate. And here too, the Rav gave an unbelievable drasha. And the Rav said, let's open the Chumash. Let's see what happened. What was the machloket between Yosef and his brothers? What troubled Yosef HaTzadik? What was the machloket between Yosef HaTzadik and his brothers? Why did Yosef have to be different? What troubled him? What were these dreams about? What took away his menuchat hanefesh? And the Rav explained, the brothers were very happy. They were living in Eretz Canaan. What were they? They were shepherds. They had a profession. They knew how to conduct themselves. They knew the land. They knew the language. They were at home. This was their culture. This was their environment. But Yosef was troubled. Yosef knew there was a promise from God, that the Jews are going to wind up in a land which is not theirs. They're going to have to go down to Egypt. They're going to be enslaved. And Yosef was troubled. How will we be prepared for tomorrow? How will we be prepared for the new technology? How will we be prepared for civilization? Egypt was the high point of world civilization at that time. They had the star, the moon, the sun, technology. As if to speak, they were computerized. They were light years beyond Eretz Canaan. And not only that, they didn't have sheep, they didn't have cattle, they were farmers, that they had technological advanced farming, they were involved in a different culture, in a different concept of civilization, a different understanding of life. How will we be prepared? And Yosef started dreaming, we have to worry about this, we have to get ready, we have to know that we're going to go down to Egypt. And we're going to have to broaden our understanding of life. And we're going to have to change our civilization. And we're going to have to alter our occupations. And we have to worry about tomorrow. And this is why he had these dreams. He wanted to spur his brothers on. He wanted them to be ready. He wanted them to care. And his brothers laughed at him. His brothers derided him. His brothers said to him, what are you worried about tomorrow? And the Rav quoted the Gemara in Chagiga, Daf Yud Gimel Lamed Aleph, Chagiga 13a, but Mufla Mincha Al Tidrosh, meaning, why do you worry about tomorrow? Because Shei Derachmana Lamlecha, why are you involved in God's secrets? A person has to live the way he lives here now, the way he lives today, what he sees, what is concrete, what he touches. That's the way a person has to live. Tomorrow, that's God's worry. That's not your concern. Let God handle it. You're here. You're now. You're happy. You're pleased. You understand. You can compete. You can perform. But tomorrow, that's God's concern. And the brothers argued with him. And now the Rav said something that is theologically, absolutely earth-shaking. The Rav told the story. When I was a child, I learned the sugya in Bava Metzia. He's referring to Tanu de Achnai, Daf Nun Tet, Daf Nun Chet, Amid Bet, Daf Nun Tet, Amid Aleph. It's a full Amid. Tanu de Achnai, and the Rav said, I cried. What was the sugya about? The sugya, it was a certain type of stove, made a certain way. And the question was whether you could purify the stove. In other words, when you have a stove that becomes impure, can you purify it? Can you be metahir it? Or do you have to destroy it and build it all over? Once you destroy it, it loses its impurity, but you have to build it all over. Or no, is there a method by which you can purify it without destroying it? And Rebbe Eliezer said you should be able to purify it. All the sages voted against him. They put it to a vote. He lost. Rebbe Eliezer was so upset. He said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if I'm right, let a torrential rain come through the Beis Medrash. A minute later, storm, flood through the Beit Medrash. And he said to the sages, look, God says I'm right. Didn't pay attention. Let all the trees be uprooted. A minute later, all the trees around the Beis Medrash, around the yeshiva were uprooted. Says to the Chachamim, take a look. God says I'm right. Didn't pay attention. Finally, the Gemara says, a heavenly voice rang out that Rebbe Eliezer is correct. And the Chachamim said to the heavenly voice, Lo bashamayim hi, but out. It's nothing to do with you. And the Rav said, I was a little kid, I learned this Gemara for the first time, I cried. Look at Rebbe Eliezer. Torrential rain. Trees uprooted. Beis Medrash is shaking. And if that's not enough, God himself rings out loud and clear, Halacha is like Rebbe Eliezer, and nothing helps. And there's an addendum to the Gemara that you should all recall. Eliyahu HaNavi meets HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says to him, Nu, how do you feel? Your sons are telling you, butt out, keep out, none of your concern. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Nitzchuni banai, Nitzchuni, my children are correct, my children are correct. And the Rav said, I cried. How could you do this, Rebbe Eliezer? He was put in chayr afterwards, right or wrong. He was put in shamta because he didn't accept the viewpoint of the majority. And the halacha remained against him, even though God's voice rang out. And the Rav said, as I got older, I understood this Gemara. You see, when God gives the Torah, and you know there's a machloket, those of you familiar with the Gemara in Shabbos, and it's also in the Medrash, there's a whole machloket nasu, hamalachim, kitei kitot, the angels became two groups, give the Torah, don't give the Torah, the Jews are worthy of the Torah, no, the Jews won't keep the Torah, but one thing is certain, once God decides to give the Torah, he has to give it within a human context. God can't expect a human being to act in a godly fashion, in a divine fashion. We are limited. Yivtak b'doro, kishmul b'doro. I'm quoting the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, of course, and it's a very important concept. Ein l'dayan, what if we're saying in the number of places in Shasana? Ein l'dayan, ela masha einav ra'at. A judge can only judge that which he sees. We're only humans, and we can't have a Torah where if we have a halachic question, we have to go up and ask God. Once God gives the Torah with the rabbinic process, the rabbinic concept, the Torah Shebaal Peh, Kadosh Baruch Hu is out of it. He can no longer paskin shilas. The Beit Din Shelmata has the paskin. And what they decide is absolutely, totally binding, and no one can mix into this process, because this is the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah, and this is the rabbinic system which he gives us, how to determine questions of Jewish law. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tries to mix in, the Chachamim say, Nitzchuni banai nitzchuni. The Chachamim say, keep out, lo bashamayim hi. And God has to agree, Nitzchuni banai nitzchuni, my children are right. So what do we see from here? When it comes to halacha, the Chachamim are the ultimate arbiters. No one can interfere with their decision. And they have to work within the confines of Torah Shebaal Peh. V'acherei Rabim Lahatot, you put it to a vote, it's the Beit Din HaGadol, this is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Pei Chet Amid Bet, we don't know what the answer is, we go all the way to the Beit HaGadol. They put it to a vote, and on their vote, that determines the halacha 100%. And dreams, and visions, and bat kols, heavenly voices ringing out, cannot interfere with the halachic process. And that's axiomatic. Zilkrei beiravhu to understanding how halacha and Torah function. Fine, the Rav said. But now there are other questions. They're hashkafic questions, not halachic questions. Questions of whether or not we should boycott. I'm giving examples. I mean, you have no idea. There's a 180-degree turnaround that has to be analyzed. Whether or not we should boycott, whether or not we should go in Aliyah, whether or not we should build the state, whether or not we should have an army, whether or not we should have a Zim ship that runs for Israel, whether or not we have to get a peace land for peace, issues that are so contemporary. Yeshiva Chesda. How do we balance out learning Torah, army service? So what's our relationship to the Pope, to the Catholic Church? How should we interact with the anti-Semitism in the Scandinavian countries today? How do we deal with the New York Times? How do we deal with CNN? There's so many questions. How do we deal with Reform Jews, conservative Jews? How do we deal with humanistic Jews? How do we deal with all these issues that haunt us today, that are not purely halachic, far from halachic? They're economic, they're moral, they're ethical, they're political, they're common sense issues. Call it what you wish. They're life and death issues, but it's not black and white halacha. You can't, in all these issues I mentioned, this is not a black and white halachic question. Should I boycott or shouldn't I boycott? Should we demonstrate against Russia? Should we demonstrate for Sharansky? Should we demonstrate for Mendelovich? These are real life political questions that have grave consequences. No, how do you handle them? And here the Rav says, not what man decides, it's what God wants. We must constantly look over our shoulder to see whether we're succeeding or not, to see whether or not this is the will of God, to see whether or not we have to alter, we have to change. Truths that we took for granted 100 years ago, 50 years ago, even a year ago, even a day ago, we have to constantly look up, because maybe now a different response, a different answer is called for. And the Rav said in Hashkafa, and now he goes back to the machloket of Yosef HaTzadik and his brothers. That was a machloket in Hashkafa. It's not a question of halacha. It's a question, do we have to worry? Do we have to get ready? Do we have to be prepared? What's going to be 50 years now? What's going to be 100 years now? Oh, no, we're here in Eretz Canaan. We're happy. We're content. We know the language. We know the land. We know the idiom. We know the sports they play. What do we have to worry about learning baseball? Here they play soccer. And Yosef says, no. God said we're going to be Gerim, Eretz Lelahem. Get ready. Get prepared. And the divine voice rang out. Yosef HaTzadik was right. Yosef saved the Jews. If not for Yosef HaTzadik, if not for the viceroy, if not for the man who went down to Egypt and showed that one could be a Talmud Chacham, a Yerusha Mayim, and be a viceroy in Paro's court, if not for Yosef, who went down and mastered the Egyptian language, the Egyptian culture, the Egyptian way of life, the Egyptian agriculture, if not for him, the Jew would not have survived the exile. And because of Yosef, we had a home. We were successful. We survived. We were able to return home to Eretz Canaan. 11 brothers voted against Yosef. The vote was 11-1 against him. But nevertheless, here it's Hashkafa. And it's not man who votes, but it has to be man who constantly is looking up, constantly reevaluating, what does God want out of me? What is the divine will? And what is the best way to discharge it? And that's why the heavenly voice here rang out like Yosef HaTzadik. And here, unlike halacha, we have to respond to the heavenly voice and not disregard it. And the Rav said very dramatically, Mizrahi of 1902. What is 1902? 100 years ago, Mizrahi was organized in Vilna. It didn't exist before 1902. Tassab. And the Rav says, Mizrahi of Tassab was the equivalent of Yosef HaTzadik of the Bible. The Aguda were like the 11 other brothers. What was the viewpoint of Agudat Yisrael? I'm here. I'm happy. I'm content. I have yeshiva. I have mir. I have slabotka. I have telj. I have brisk. I have rotten. Eisershuk. Vilna. Hasidic world. We have Warsaw. We have Ger. We have Belz. We have Chotkov. We have Alexander. We have Lubavitch. But kibshei the rachmana lamali. Why worry about the secrets? We're here now. We're satisfied. We have children. We speak. Wir reden die Sprache. We speak Yiddish. We know the language. We're at home. And Mizrahi said, look what's happening. Look at the anti-Semitism. Look at Dreyfus. Even in the most civilized countries, look what they shout and yell. Death to the Jews outside the Beit Mishpat, outside the court in Paris, 1894. The most civilized country in the world. The mother of Western democracy, of Western idealism. France. Look at the pogroms in Europe. Look how much blood was shed. Look what happened during World War I. Look how many armies, whenever they wanted to practice their spears, their knives, who did they practice on? Who did they kill, if not the Jews? Look what's happening. Look at the irreligiousness. Look what's overtaking us. Look at the communism. We have to be prepared. We have to have a land of refuge. We have to return. We have to build Eretz Yisrael. Where will we go? Where will we turn? What will happen to Torah? We have to worry about tomorrow. Look up. Try to understand what God is doing. You can't just paskin the shaylah and walk away. You have to think and review. And maybe the answers we gave 5 and 10 and 15, 20 years ago are no longer correct, are no longer relevant. This is not kasher atreif. This is not tahara tameh. This is not pure or impure. This is not permitted or forbidden. This is an ongoing question. And we must always look up to see where is the divine providence leading us and how do we have to prepare ourselves for tomorrow. And the Rav said dramatically, the Hashgacha Pratit run out loud and clear and announced, Yosef HaTzadik Mizrahi of 1902 was correct. And the Rav said, where would we be today following the Holocaust? Where would the displaced persons have gone? You don't remember that period. You're too young. But there were hundreds of thousands of people who had no home to go to. They didn't want to return to Poland, didn't want to return to the Ukraine, didn't want to return to the land that was now communist or the land that was saturated with the blood of their parents, their siblings, their brothers, their sisters, their children, their spouses. And Palestine was closed at that time. The white paper, America, you needed relatives to vouch for you. The quotas, we had no place to go. Give us a home. And the state was declared. The doors were open. And hundreds of thousands alu arzabarina. Some of them just got off the boats and immediately went into the Israeli Defense Forces to fight for the nascent Jewish state. Some of them lost their lives. Some of them are buried. Plony Almoni, there was even no time to find out who they were from the time they got off the boat to the time they went to fight. And look at the yeshiva. Look where they went. Look where Mir came. And look where Bris came. And look where the great Hasidic centers came. Look where Ger came. Look where Belz came. Look at Bnei Brak. Look what happened here. And this is all because of the Mizrahi, that they prepared a home. They fought. They dreamed. They were visionaries. They suffered. They went in Aliyah. They followed the example of Yosef HaTzadik of the Bible. And the heavenly voice rings out, Yosef HaTzadik of 1902, the Mizrahi, his viewpoint is correct. Their attitude is correct. This is the way to go. This is the way to succeed. We have to reevaluate and we see how it blossoms. We see Torah in the Holy Land. This is why I became a Mizrahiite. I need not tell you that this statement is extremely powerful. The hashkafic implications are earth-shaking. It is the antithesis of Das Torah. What does Das Torah tell you? That in all non-halachic issues, the great rabbis issue rulings. They're the ones that give the guidance, and their words are, as if to speak, infallible. There was an article, and I cited in a footnote in the Rav, in the biographical section of Volume 1. It's an article in the Yearly Years of Jewish Observer, I believe it's 1963, by Rabbi Bernard Weinberger, rabbi of the Yisrael of Williamsburg, himself of Hungarian origins, I believe a Torah Vadas boy. And he wrote an article. This is when Agudo was really going on the map in America. And he wrote an article on Das Teira, where he referred to it as slightly less than a heavenly voice. He referred, when rabbis give a decision on a non-halachic issue, it is practically like a bat kol ringing out a heavenly voice. The Rav here is saying, no. Rabbis have to make decisions. Rabbis have to provide guidance. Rabbis, and we'll talk about this at a later time, rabbis need expert advice from lay people who know the fields in which they have to make decisions. But even when they've made a decision, they have to constantly reevaluate, because there's no such concept here as Das Torah. There's no such concept as finality. It is an ongoing process. Yosef HaTzadik had to constantly look up. What is he doing in Egypt? How does he learn the language? What role does he play? How is he the viceroy? What does he do with agriculture? How does he bring his brothers down? How does he introduce the brothers? And you had to constantly evaluate, did I act correctly? Is what I did proper? Did it accomplish its purpose? And this is exactly what the Rav is saying. Rabbis play a role in life way beyond the narrow confines of halacha, no question about it. But in that additional role, it is markedly different than halacha. Halacha, if it's kosher, it's kosher. The minute you give the psak, you don't reevaluate. Ein masa beitin acharei masa beitin. It's done. That's it. The minute you said it's treif, it's treif. It's finished. That's why when you ask a question, you know you're not allowed to go to another rabbi without telling him I asked the previous rabbi. You give a psak, tahar, tamei, and aguna, you're matir. Once you're matir, you're matir. You're permitted to remarry, she remarries. That's the halacha. But with hashkafa, constantly reevaluating. Now, I want to add one small thought that the Rav didn't say at the time, but in my humble opinion, I'm positive this was in back of his mind. And of course, what I'm referring to is the original lecture that I gave in the series. How did I begin? I began by quoting the Rambam in Hilchot Malachim, Perek Yud Bet, Halacha Bet. And what did the Rambam say? Isn't that exactly what the Rav is saying now? What did the Rambam say when it comes to the future redemption, the future Geula, when it comes to Achrit HaYamim, the end of days? The Rambam says it's impossible for us to describe exactly how it will take place. This is not something we can delineate halachically. Remember the words of the Rambam? There is such contradiction among the sages. Lefi chacham ru chachamim, tipach rucham. Two different yesod. But one thing we see, anyone who tries to tell you exactly the way it's going to be, may his mind lose its knowledge, or in stronger language, may he lose the ability to breathe, which is maledicting him that he should die. May he drop dead. Tipach rucham is a lot worse than tipach taitam, although I don't know. Some people may tell you it's better to be dead than to lose one's mind. There's truth to that too. But what does the Rambam say? We'll only know when we live it. Aren't those the words of the Rambam? Didn't I show it to you? And isn't this exactly what the Rav is saying? When we're living it, we constantly have to reevaluate where our hashkafa is, where our theological outlook is. We constantly have to look up, constantly have to look to reality, constantly have to look to see what the results are. And that's why I became a Mizrachiite, because their results were infinitely better than the viewpoint of Agudat Yisrael, which said, stay behind, stand pat, do nothing to prepare for tomorrow. And Mizrachi built the land, joined with the secular Zionists, gave us a country that provided refuge on a physical level and on a spiritual level. My dear friends, we're coming into World War III. The final point of today's lecture, but the point that shakes the world to its very inner core. We have to pay our respects to the great Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, Rabbi Eliezer Menachem Man Shach, Sefer Tzadik Levracha. Rav Shach, who was privileged to arich Jamim Tovim and lived, no one knows for sure when he was born, but one thing is obvious, that he lived well over 100 years, functioned for basically 95 years out of 100 plus, 95 years functioned totally. And here's an individual, again, you have to understand, his mesirat nefesh to learning Torah is indescribable. Here's a man that walked from his hometown to a yeshiva tens of kilometers away in cold weather with barely a pair of shoes on his feet. Legend has it that someplace in Lakewood, these shoes are on a safe. And if a kid is not a matmid, they take him in and open the safe and show him the shoes and say to him, you're complaining, you don't have time, you don't have this. These are the shoes that Rav Shach wore when he walked endless kilometers because he couldn't afford to pay for transportation to come back to learn Torah. His Mesirat Nefesh, his learning during World War I, the stories are legendary. And Rav Shach, of course, goes on to come an aliyah to the State of Israel. He marries into the Rabbi Zalman family, the Rabbi Aaron Cutler family. He marries Rabbi Zalman's niece, who was a student in medical school when she was taken out by her great uncle to marry Rav Shach, but she certainly was more than a nurse. She was a medical assistant all her life. And Rabbi Aaron Cutler, of course, is the son-in-law of Rabbi Zalman. So you see already Rav Shach's family, his background, his learning, his knowledge, his dedication, totally to the Lithuanian concept of life, to a certain degree, who Rabbi Aaron Cutler was in America, Rav Shach was in the State of Israel, to a certain degree. It's not as marked as Rabbi Aaron Cutler, because Rav Shach comes on the scene after the Panitzer, which Rabbi Shlomo Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman, but to a certain degree. Now, Rav Shach certainly knew of the Rav, and certainly knew that he and the Rav differed widely on many topics, although the basic commitment to Lithuanian Torah was one and the same. What is fascinating is that in all the published writings of Rav Shach and their manifold, he never attacks the Rav. If you open up the Aviezri, which I did when I came in Aliyah, because in America in 1969 we didn't hear about Rav Shach. I only knew about him because his son was my classmate in many classes in the Bernard Revel Graduate School, Dr. Ephraim Shach, who got his doctorate about a year after I did. So I knew he had a father who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Hadarom, then in Panovich. And he's supposed to be a Yid, a Litvish, a London. But when I came in Aliyah, early 70s, he was a lot more than just another Rosh Yeshiva. So I went to the library and I took out his Aviezri on the Rambam and I opened it up and Hilchot Talmud Torah. And there was a piece of Torah there on a woman studying Torah, Birchat HaTorah. And I couldn't believe my eyes. It was exactly what I heard from the Rav. Exactly. So I saw right away that their approach is exactly the same. Both Lithuanians, both analyzing a Rambam. They were both influenced by Rav Chaim. And I saw their approach. I mean, unknown one to the other, independently of one the other. The chidushim they said on that particular sugya of understanding whether or not a woman can say birchat the Torah because she's not obligated to study Torah, their approach was a photo image. So from that I saw, Baruch Hashem, they're from the same school. With all that Rav Shach wrote, he never criticized the Rav. The only time he ever criticized the Rav was on this drasha. And here you have to hear the criticism. The only time Rav Shach understood that if this drasha is correct, Agudat Yisrael has a very definite earth-shaking theological problem. I'll tell you where the source is, and it's fascinating how this comes to Rav Shach. I'm quoting to you from the fourth volume of his collected letters. It's called Mikhtavim U'Maimarim, Chelek Dalet. I'm quoting on page 35. There are two letters, one after another, on against the Rav from Boston. How does it come to Rav Shach? And Rav Shach tells the story. A student in Panovich picked up the Chamesh Drashot. And this student was very smart. He saw right away what I told you a few minutes ago, that in the Chamesh Drasha, these few pages on Yosef V'Yachav, it is earth shaking. It is a hydrogen bomb. And this student picked it up. And he writes to Rav Shach, Gam karati et shelatchem. The mashin is dainly adchem, sefer chamesh drashot, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, Shiachem mi Boston. He says, and I'm aware of your question. And you say to me that you read there a hashkafa that's totally different from all the hashkafa you've heard in Panovich, in the yeshiva, all your life. You see the hashkafa that deals with Das Teira and the relationship of Am Yisrael, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and how to act on a daily basis, and it's totally different than that which I taught you. And you ask me, how can this be? Explain it to you. Okay. Rav Shach writes, I never saw the Sefer, let me be honest with you. However, after you sent me the letter, Hitayanti lirat ha-sefa, and I decided to look at some of his writings. And first, he's critical here. He says that a volume came out in honor of the Rav, Kavod HaRav. It came out, I believe, on the Rav's 80th birthday, if I'm not mistaken. And Rav Shach says he sees so many Rabbanim wrote Divrei Torah in honor of the Rav. How could they write this if the man could write what he wrote in Chamesh Drasha? So he criticizes the Rabbanim who write and don't protest the Rav's Chamesh Drasha. But then he writes another letter. And he says, now I've had a chance to read it and I can respond. And he says as follows, there's a double criticism of the Rav. One is not that important, and one is the earth-shaking, head-on clash. The not-so-important criticism, he says, who gave the right the Rav to dashen like this? Where's his Mesorah? How does he talk about Yosef HaTzadik and the brothers, that this was their fight? Everything we talk about has to be based upon Mesorah. And Shalonim Sirolo Midore Dorot Shalafaneinu. How did he reach such a conclusion? Gentlemen, with all due respect to Rav Shach, this is not a serious critique for one simple reason. This is what Dashanut is all about. Homiletical license is legendary. Chazal already said, Ein Sho'alim Al Hadrush. You're all familiar with that. Homiletical license is homiletical license. And if we're going to criticize the Rav for this magnificent drasha because he puts words into the mouths of Yosef HaTzadik and the brothers, then we have to criticize thousands of drush svarim that were written throughout the ages by Gedoli Hadashanim and Gedoli Yisrael. And this critique of Rav Shach, even a little person like myself can refute. That's not a heavyweight critique. But then he comes to the other critique. And here, Rav Shach says, what is he talking about? Of course, halacha is given to the Rabbanim, and of course, God can't mix in. But on every question, you have to hear the opinion of the Rabbanim. And it's not just pure halacha. Das Teira, and these are his words, Shebechol davar yesh das Teira, v'zu hi hamachrahat b'chol sheila. I'm speaking Ashkenazis Hebrew because I'm talking about Rav Shach. It comes natural already. I'm in Panovich. I've heard Rav Shach speak. But Rav Shach is saying here that in every issue you have to turn to rabbis. And in every issue there is das Teira. And Rav Shach brings a proof. The breastplate. What were some of the questions you asked the Choshen Mishpat when you went to the Kohen Gadol? No, you learned the Gemara. Shall I fight or shouldn't I fight? Ya'aleh or lo ya'aleh? Should I go to war or I shouldn't go to war? Wasn't one of these the very basic questions that they asked the Choshen Mishpat? So you see that the same Kohen that you asked the Tzitz, you asked the Choshen Mishpat question. And he says, this is Das Teira. It includes everything. How can you separate? And Rav Shach says, Chas v'chalila, that you're going to say that the Sanhedrin only was Masur Ach v'rak to these very unique questions in Halacha, and all the other questions of who should be the head of the army and who should go to war and how you should fight and all the questions and how to ask, and there's sugya shleimus on this, entire gemaras, how do you ask, how do you phrase the question, ha'elo, lo'ala, this you don't ask the Choshen? The same person who's the tzitz is the Choshen. And literally, he's paraphrasing the Rav's hesped on Reb Chaim Oyser Grishinsky. And this is the head-on clash. You know what's amazing? The Rav has that very concept. When he talks about the hesped of Reb Chaim Oyser Grishinsky, he makes that very point. He quotes the very concept, ale o lo ale. In other words, exactly what Rav Shach is saying here. Did the Rav really change his mind? How would the Rav deal with this critique? Didn't answer Rav Shach. By 1984 already, the Rav was barely functioning. But in my humble opinion, even assuming that the Rav's husband and Rav Chaim Oyser is correct, even assuming that Rav Shach's critique of the Rav is correct, it doesn't defeat or negate or abrogate what the Rav said in Chamesh Drashot. And in my humble opinion, the difference is very simple. When it comes to halacha, of course you ask the rabbis. And whatever they paskin is final. You don't have to look up, don't have to look down. This is the psak. When it comes to hashkafa, you can very well ask a rabbi, and a rabbi can very well give you an answer, and the Choshen Mishpat can very well give you an answer. But as the war continues, as history unfolds, as the Jewish destiny marches along, you constantly have to look up again and reevaluate. And that's the way I believe the Rav would refute Rav Shach's critique. You can't deny, Hayim Aleh, but you asked, you're in the term, when do you ask? And when you make Mulchama, you need Rishut of the Sanhedrin. These are all concepts of Halacha, right or wrong. Particularly Mulchamet Rishut, you have to go to the Sanhedrin and ask permission. But we're talking here, this is a permission which they're going to answer, which they're going to grant on the basis of the political, military, monetary, economic reality. It's on the basis of the here, the now, the tangible. It's on the basis that we understand we'll constantly have to reevaluate our opinion as we see the divine plan unfold. So it's fascinating that Rav Shach critiques the heart of the Rav's thinking, and Rav Shach comes back to the tzitz and the choshen. I don't know, perhaps he wasn't familiar with the Hesped Rav Chaim Oyser, because he says he sought out particularly this particular Chamesh Drashot where you don't have the Hesped Rav Chaim Oyser. But there is a big difference, nevertheless, willy-nilly, between answering a question of the tzitz and answering a question of the choshen. And in my opinion, this is the Rav's viewpoint. If we take Rav Shach's critique, then we simply have to add one more small addendum, that when the tzitz paskins, you don't come back to the question. That's it. That's the psak. This is the halacha. When the choshen gives you an answer, that question may have to be re-asked and rethought, because situations change, times change, people change, our tzitka changes, maybe zachinu that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to have rachamim on us, and maybe it's hestapanim, and we have to react within the context of the situation in which we find ourselves as time moves on. So even allowing for Rav Shach's critique, I can still refine it and define it within the Rav's point of view. Okay? And let me just end off. Let me go one step further. Of course, where the Rav says that Mizrahi saved the Torah in the state of Israel, here, of course, Rav Shach takes him to task. And here, of course, this is simply Mizrahi versus Aguda, with all that is happening in the land. I have to tell you that these words that were written in 1984, at least published in 1984, might have been written earlier. There's no date on the letters. These words are as true today and are in the headlines today, just as they were 20 years ago. And he says, what? The Rav says Mizrahi provided makom leTorah beYisrael, ha-hefechu, just the opposite. Shadavar yadua l'rabim u'mefursim shein l'tnuat ha-mizrachi shum shayechet l'habetz haTorah. That Mizrahi in Israel is not all involved with teaching and preaching and spreading the study of Torah, the Adarabah. And just the opposite, the Yeshiva Tichoniyot and the Yeshiva Chesed Kiyotzebechem hang miyatu v'iktinu et hadumutsha gadlut b'Torah v'shifa liyot gadol b'Torah. And he says just the opposite, that the Yeshiva Tichoniyot, the Yeshiva High Schools and the Yeshiva Chesda have minimized, have simply put down the image of the Talmud Chacham who wants to be a Gadol B'Torah. And he says exactly the opposite is true. And he goes on to a whole analysis, and if the Yeshiva Chesda and the Yeshiva Tichoniyot had any success, he says, you know where that success came from? Because real yeshiva people taught in these programs. And he says, now, in the yeshiva of Oja, take Dila Sotra, she yeshiva Pnei Akiva, the yeshiva Tichoniyot, the Gadru Gidro, the Gazru Gezeira, the Shanim Achronot, that the heads of the Bnei Akiva yeshiva and the yeshiva high schools have made a Gezeira that they don't want their students to go to the real big, wonderful yeshiva that are in the spirit of tradition and all the generations that come before us, he says. And if there was any success, it's because these type of Rashi yeshiva taught there from the traditional yeshivas, and now they're attempting to make a total break with this environment, with this element, with these individuals. And the Ein Ruach HaChameinu Gedolei HaTorah Shel Hayom v'Rashi Yeshiva Mefursamot Nocha Mimenu. And he says that the great Rashi yeshiva of today, their spirit is not pleased with this development. So you see, he takes the Rav to task. What do you mean? Israel's a Makom Torah. Mizrahi built a Makom Torah. Mizrahi encourages the study of Torah. He takes the Rav to task and criticizes and critiques the Merkaz Yeshiva Bnei Akiva. What Rav Shach didn't realize, and here I end off, and I tell a story that I never told before in public, because I was sworn to secrecy by the family, but I see if Rav Aaron Lichtenstein could publish the story in the last issue of Alon Shvut, it's permitted for me to tell the story as an addendum to Rav Shach's critique. Let me tell you the following. In the early 70s, the Rav won a prize. It was the Zalman Shazah Prize for Education, Chinuch in the Gola, and he was honored with the prize. It was a very substantial prize of I believe, 10,000 Israeli lira, which was quite a few thousand dollars at the time. The Lichtensteins accepted the prize on behalf of the Rav. There was a party at the president's house, but of course the Rav was in America, the Rav was not here, and then they called the Rav and they said, Papa, we have this prize we won, it's a large check, what should we do with it? And without hesitating for a moment, the Rav said, sign my name and give it as a donation to Merkaz Yeshivat Bnei Akiva, I believe in Tel Aviv at the time. They may still be in Tel Aviv. And the Rav told them where to put the check. So my dear friends, to reiterate, yes, today was a very important lecture of shifting sands. The Hespet Rav Chaim Moisa was 100% on a good statement, beyond and unlike any statement ever made in American soil before, subsequently, or afterwards. The March on Washington, as I will explain next week, plays a great role in the Rav's thinking. And I will explain next week a post-World War II thinking. And I will analyze that next week, Bezrat Hashem. Why the Rav became a Mizrahiite, his drusher of Yosef and his brothers, is classic. It is the most far-reaching, practical, hashkafic, philosophic, theological statement I know of that the Rav has ever made. Rav Shach understood it. And it's fascinating, of all that the Rav has written, and by 1984, a lot had been published of the Rav's Chidushei Torah, the Shirim Lezeicha B'Mari, and the Al HaTshuva, and Machshav, and the Ish Halacha, and so much had been published already, thousands of pages already, and Rav Shach only reacted to a few paragraphs in Chamesh Drashot. But Rav Shach understood, if the Rav is correct, then Das Teira is not correct, as Agudat Yisrael understands it. And if Agudat Yisrael is correct, obviously, then the Rav and Mizrahi fall by the wayside. And these two giants, take a look at that last paragraph I quoted, Mekhash, Yeshivat Bnei Akiva, and their attitude, and Rav Shach's critique, and take a look at the Rav when he wins this substantial prize in the early 1970s. Where does he say to give it? To give it to Mekhash Yeshivat Bnei Akiva. Be'ezrat Hashem, next week we'll pick up right from here, and we'll go into the 1943 march and Divrei Torah from the Rav afterwards, and how it affects his entire global Weltanschauung as a Jew, as a Rav, as a Rosh Yeshiva, and how it leads him once again beyond Yosef Liachov, how it leads him so squarely and firmly into the Mizrahi movement. Thank you very much for your kind participation.